distance that it strikes the moon. Interesting question. I think it has something to do with it being transmitted out more isotropically than it's being transmitted to it, but that could be wrong. So a little description on that if you can, thank you.
Yeah, you're going to get a similar answer here, depending on whether or not you're using linear polarization or circular polarization. In both cases, they behave the same. The moon is something like 2,500 miles in diameter. So therefore, from the sub-Earth point on the moon, in other words, the center of the moon from your point of view, over to the limb of the moon, is something like 1,200 miles. And that's at radio frequencies, that's something like 6 milliseconds of delay. So in other words, if you transmitted a very brief pulse to the moon, the portion that hits the center of the moon, where the moon is the closest to you, that's where the earliest part of the echo comes back. A little bit later, there's a ring of dirt, a wrap point. There's the ring you could draw around that point, which has, let's say, 1 millisecond of delay. And another ring larger around that, it's got 2 milliseconds of delay, and so on. So all of those additional depth portions of the moon give you additional delay. So you could transmit a 1 microsecond in very close to the moon, and because the moon has an electronic depth of, I think it's 6 milliseconds, you're going to get back a 6 millisecond pulse. But the pulse is going to have a weird characteristic to it. The beginning of the pulse, at 6 milliseconds long, is going to be very strong. The end of this pulse, 6 milliseconds later, is going to be very weak. And the reason for that is the portions of the moon out at the perimeter, from your point of view, are aimed in the wrong direction. In theory, you would get no signal from that at all. But the moon is a bumpy object. So you're getting continuous echo from every portion of the moon, but it's delayed in time, depending on the depth of that particular portion. And this is true for circular or linear. It's not a function of what polarization you use. So you do get a dispersed signal. You get a signal, every signal you come back from moon bounce is smeared in time. If you're sending slow speed Morse code, 6 milliseconds of delay is less than the length of one of your dots, and it doesn't really matter per se. When you send single sideband voice to the moon, that smearing does give you a very characteristic sound, which takes some practice to be able to understand it. I wonder if I should run that by again, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I believe that was a sufficient explanation. Now, the other point of this would be the reflected signal from a different area. As that radius of curvature starts to go around, either east or west, that would be a weaker signal, and his equipment would have to be able to resolve and be able to detect, would have to have that sensitivity. So if he sent a sharp, short burst, he may hear the second one, but he may not hear a third. Is that correct?
You basically got it, John. The strongest part of the echo comes from the center of the moon, the part that's closest to you, where the dirt is most parallel to the path, if you know what I mean, and most at right angles to the path. So if you've got a system that's only got 1 dB of threshold, that's the only portion you're going to hear, and you don't even know that there is a smear, that there's delayed signals that are weaker, delayed in time that are weaker in amplitude. You don't even know that. But if you've got a strong enough system, you will hear all of those extra delays. Everything's being smeared in the time domain. That was a little bit of the problem of the early ECHO project, where they had a smooth balloon, you know, a mylar-covered, very large balloon that they put into orbit. And by setting up these great big ground stations, one of them in Maine and a couple of them scattered other places around the world, one of them in Homedale, New Jersey, they wanted to use a moon in orbit, a round balloon in orbit as a passive echoing device, no battery on board. On paper, it sounds good. Unfortunately, you put something in space, little meteorites and whatever are hearing it, it eventually becomes deflated and starts taking on other shapes and starts tumbling and it's also a very high area to low mass ratio object, so the continuous drag and slow it down. So a passive gives you a tremendous amount of signal weakness on what comes back when we drop. A tremendous amount of weakening of the signal that comes back versus what went out. So its advantage. It's also got the disadvantage that the it doesn't hold the shape and it doesn't stay in orbit. So we eventually ended up with electronic satellites. It's a lot more expensive and more difficult to put solar cells and batteries and whatever. But because the electronics inside the satellite has something like 100 decibels of gain, the signal you get back from the electronic satellite, you could say, is probably 80 decibels stronger than the signal you would have gotten from just a purely passive mylar-covered balloon. So now you can see why the ECHO project, that was the balloons, and also Project Westford. Project Westford was a whole bunch of little pieces of wire, zillions of pieces of wire put into orbit. Again, they didn't stay in orbit very long. They're not all in one spot, and the echo you got from them is very weak because it's a darn many miles away. So they rapidly came to the conclusion that all of your satellites in space better have electronics on board. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. No, they tried to save a few bucks. It didn't work out. Yes, I remember Echo 1. Nice. Okay. So that was one of the problems with that. Very interesting. That's about it from Mel's Corner. And I hope young people out there that were listening that were asking these questions, well, two of them I know were young. The other one I don't know for sure. But I hope they got the benefit of this. We'll try to pick up Paul and get a space report, and then I have a question also. And we'll see if anybody else can wants to come in here. Dick, back to you, KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. We're back in normal operation, so you can go back to the normal frequencies. You sure you don't have another one of those emails you want to handle? Because we're back in full operation. And if not, I'll see if Paul's available. Well, let's go to Paul first. WS2N, if you're there, Paul. K2RIW on the TechNet.
I'm going to go back to 85.
Roger, Dodger.
Good on.
Paul, are you there?
Yes, Dick. WS2N, you copy?
Copy loud and clear. You sound beautiful. Please proceed.
Okay, should I go through Glen Oaks or Selman? Right now I'm going through Selman.
Stay where you are. It's working very well.
Okay, copy that. Very good. I'll leave it. Just two topics really tonight, but I thought I'd bring up there was a repair that was done to the Curiosity Mars Science Laboratory that's on site in Mars that we'll be getting there in August, actually August 5th. And that was launched last year in November. And 3 days after the launch, they had a problem where it actually went into a reboot mode. And the engineers, they all got together and figured out what this problem was. And apparently it was some kind of an idiosyncrasy in the registry memory that they dealt with, and they duplicated the problem many, many times here on Earth, you know, with their own equipment. And it had to do with Curiosity, looking at the stars using the star finder. All the spacecraft use the sun and the stars to navigate to get to wherever they're going. And that's where it locked up. Can we drop it? So that was put back together. Set up another program and got that thing running the way it's supposed to be. And they don't predict any other problems with that, it was a fluke type of thing, but they did figure out how it all came about. So that was one thing. The other thing is there's a piece of equipment that's going to be sent up to the International Space Station, and it's called a scan test bed. What it is really a software-defined radio system that they're going to attach to the outside of the International Space Station. It's going to be launched by Japanese Aerospace Exploration. You know, Japan's going to launch it. They're the version of NASA. And it's built here in the States, but they're going to cargo spacecraft. You know, there's many different cargo craft that go to the space station. Of course, the progress by Russia goes up there, and the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicles by European Space Agency that brings supplies up there. And we also have the Japanese version called the H2, and that, you know, it's called the H2 transfer vehicle, and that goes up there with a you know, some 12,000 pound payload. And on board, I guess a couple of months from now, I couldn't find a launch date, but the equipment is being tested now. This software-defined radio system. Let me drop it. That's going to be attached. I mean, it's really going to go up in this H2. Well, it gets launched by the H2B. That's their rocket that launches it, and then the H2 is the transfer vehicle itself. With all the equipment on board, including this radio. And that gets bolted to the outside of the space station to a piece called the Express Logistics Carrier. There's four of these things. This is going to be attached to the third one. And what this amounts to is, if you were to see it being built, it's about the size of an average patio in a backyard. It's a 15,000-pound contraption that gigantic frame that's attached to the truss section in various places on the space station. And what that enables them to do is to put outdoor experiments on these things, and you know, they bring them up, they can bring them back, they can leave them there like they're going to do with this. And this is technology that's going to be used to have astronauts in the future use different modern, maybe things that aren't even invented yet, communications. Let me drop it. By having this software-defined radio system, you can change everything. You can send up a program and change it automatically. So you can imagine being on a deep space mission and they decide, well, here's something that hasn't come up yet. We'll change everything around, and you'll be able to communicate better with us, maybe a different bit rate or whatever it might be. So, you know, we do have that today. And here's another thing that was pioneered by ham. That's one reason I bring it up. Not only is it radio equipment. I mean, initially you got, you know, it started up with the military back in the early 80s. But as I was looking through the different companies that were involved, with the software-defined radio system, I was looking down a list, actually on Wikipedia, and they, you know, they had names like Pop Radio, Lector Radio. I saw Harris, but then I saw Flex. I said, oh, I know Flex. That's advertised in QST all the time. And on the internet, they talked about this one guy that was really involved with it in the early days. Charles Youngblood, and his call is K5SDR. You know, SDR meaning, you know, he does that for the software-defined radio, I guess. And here's another example of ham's involvement. And if you look at his company, there's like dozens of people, you know, in the higher part of his company, all the way down to the engineers, you know, from vice presidents to him, to they're all hams. It's unbelievable. So, I thought I'd bring that up. This is WS2N. And, you know, they use a system for amateur radio called a quadrature sampling detecting. And basically that replaces mixes and things like that. And, they don't have these super heterodyne systems. They're almost like direct conversion systems. And they claim they're a lot better. But long and short of it, you know, you could actually change what these transceivers are doing. So they're going to have these things on board the space station. And I guess as time goes on, they're going to experiment with different frequencies, maybe different forms of modulation. Who knows? Just thought I'd bring that up. That's pretty much it. Those two topics: Curiosity and the SDRs. Back to that. WS2N.
Very fine, Paul. I got a question. So this launch vehicle by Japan, which is called the H-2, is the vehicle, and the booster is H-2B. It's going to be bringing this hardware, scan test board, up to the International Space Station. Has any Japan launch vehicle ever docked with the International Space Station up to now? I'm getting the impression that maybe no, that this is about to be a first. So, has Japan ever docked with the International Space Station before? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, that was back, I don't know if it was the middle or the end, but it was 2009 was the first time. And then they did it again, I think, last year, early last year. And it looks like a big cylinder when it gets up there. I mean, it's not much of a spacecraft, but it's long. It's about 30 feet long, 12 feet in diameter. And they don't really dock. It's not a docking operation. They get up close, I mean, real close to it, and what they do is they get the Canadian robot arm 2. They call it 2 because the first one was always in the shuttle. But Canadian robot arm number 2, operated by the astronauts on board, they grab a hold of this thing, and then they'll take stuff out of it, or in this case, they're going to do an EVA, and believe it or not, with a robot. And there's a couple of things. They do have a Dexter, the robot on board, and big freaking thing. And they'll robotically with that, a Canadian robotic arm, attaches to this platform. And, you know, these platforms are located in various places. For instance, this one, you know, they have a Nadir one, and then they have looking up, and then they have one, looking down, and then they have the Zenith one for looking up. But this one is looking down because they want to communicate directly with the locations on Earth, the testing, things like that. So that's attached to, and then in this case, the P3 truss segment. There's 11 of these truss segments, each one about 30 feet long. That's where you get about a little over 300 feet length of truss connections. That's roughly how long the space station is, over 300 feet long. And it'll be there and operate for at least the next 5 years, they said. Back to you, Dick.
Vehicle, this cargo vehicle, alongside of the space station, do they have a tether out there? What do you call that now? A dockside rope? What keeps the two together? How come they don't drift apart, Paul? Or maybe they use station keeping. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, well, no, they'll grab it with the arm and then they'll put it into the port. They have these, what are they called? Same things that the, like the shuttle docks do. And then they can open up a door and take things out. But what happens is the spacecraft itself doesn't dock. It doesn't have thrusters. You know, they don't maneuver and dock themselves like the Progress ships do. Progress comes up there, nobody in it, all automatic, comes up to the space station and docks. That's what I mean. This thing will grab a hold of it and buzz it and then do whatever they have to do to unload it. You know, 13,000 pounds of stuff, so they start, you know, they got a door, they open it up, start bringing bags of waters, M&Ms, clothes, whatever it is, and equipment, and you name it. So it's the third time it'll be going up. ATV has gone up, I believe, twice by the European Space Agency. And the Progress goes up at least every 6 months, usually probably about every 4 or 5 months. And now we're going to have eventually the Dragon will go up there, and then years from now the Dream Chaser. So there's all kinds of, vehicles that will be going up there. Maybe someday Orion, too, if they can get that thing off the ground. But that one's really being built for a deep space mission. But everything's being built to make sure it can dock with the space station.
Very well done. Thank you. Interesting. Okay. That's amazing to me that Curiosity had this error in the computer program. So after launching it toward Mars, is it Mars? Yeah, I think it's Mars. It's this huge laboratory that's going to land on Mars. You decide to reload the program while it's in space. Boy, you got to be careful when you do that. You load in a program that's got a glitch in it, and it aims its antenna in the wrong direction. You can't talk to it anymore. You got to be very careful with that. That's brain surgery. That's remotely controlled brain surgery, Paul, from one point of view. Direct memory access, as they say. Thank you. John had another question, so go right here with your question, John. KC2WGB. And you can come in on whichever input you like. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm coming in at 25. Dick, let's see if anybody else is out there. I think I hogged enough time. Let's see if there's any other questions for the TechNet, and then we'll go with that.
So we'll double check. Was there anyone else who signed in besides, Jim, Dave, Vito, and AK1NS? I think I'm not sure he came back, but I think that's the only ones who signed in. Did we skip anybody? I think we didn't, John, so go right ahead with your question.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I have a question about satellite transmission. If there is a satellite, not geosynchronous, just sitting out there, and we have the Earth spinning, we have a transmitter on the West Coast that is talking to the satellite. Now, you were talking about frequency controls and things like that. I was just interested in knowing if the Doppler effect from the Earth's rotation, let's say the satellite is in the equatorial plane, does that have to be taken into consideration? And is that adjustment done the same way you were talking about the transmitted frequency controlling the satellite? If you could just give me a little breakdown on that, and then that'll be my last question.
If you and I were in two separate space trips, John, sitting side by side, we're traveling at, 10,000 miles an hour. You and I are in our parallel spacecraft heading for Jupiter, and we're both sitting a mile apart. But we're both going to Jupiter. We're both moving 10,000 miles an hour compared to the Earth. one kind of a person would say, hey, I calculate the Doppler shift of signals going to and from your spacecraft. I calculate the signals going to my spacecraft and then try to make that all come out right. If I was sending a signal from me to you, the fact that we're both moving 10,000 miles an hour does not matter. If the relative motion between you and I and our two parallel spacecraft is 0 miles an hour, there is no Doppler shift. So it's only relative. By the same token, when it comes to putting something in orbit around the Earth, let me drop. I can put it in orbit very low to the Earth. It's called the low Earth orbit, LEO, L-E-O. And that's usually 200 or so nautical miles up. I can then put it into a medium Earth orbit, MEO, roughly 10,000 miles up. That's where the global positioning satellites are. Or I can put it in a geosynchronous orbit, GEOs, LEO, MEO, and GEO. A GEO is roughly 22,300 miles up. The nice thing about the LEO is the satellite is out there 22,300 miles above the surface of the Earth, but because it goes around the Earth once every 24 hours, and it's over the equator, and the Earth turns once every 24 hours, once you aim your dish up at that satellite, even though it's moving 6,000 miles an hour out there, and it's 22,300 miles away from you, relative to you on the ground, it is not moving. You talk to a geosynchronous satellite, even though it's moving 6,000 miles an hour, in its higher orbit around the Earth, relative to you and your ground station, it is not moving. There is no Doppler. And that's for the guy that's directly below it. And out at the horizon, somebody over there in England is talking to it. And somebody over there in Hawaii is talking to it. They got these great big angles, but they both can see it at the same time. But the way it is moving, compared to each one of those three ground stations I just described to you, let me drop. It is not moving. There is no Doppler. So, LEOs give you a lot of Doppler. They're moving 17,500 miles an hour compared to the surface of the Earth. GEOs give you quite a bit less Doppler. I don't know their exact velocity, but I'm going to make a guess that it's 12,000 miles an hour at 10,000 miles altitude. They give you a small amount of Doppler, and GEOs give you no Doppler at all. That's if it's in a equatorial orbit. Life gets a little bit more complicated if it's in a polar orbit. Now it's in a polar orbit. The Earth is turning underneath that disk of that orbit, if you know what I mean. And now you're going to be getting a complicated Doppler on each one of those three satellites, LEO, MEO, and GEO, if it's in polar orbit. So you calculate Doppler by what is the relative velocity between you and me on the uplink, and therefore you can calculate, knowing the Doppler on the uplink, what frequency is the satellite going to see. And by the same token, now you know what signal is coming out of the, what frequency is coming out of the satellite, what's the relative velocity between the satellite and the station it's talking to, and that's the Doppler on that side. So, in the case of a low Earth orbit ham radio satellite, let me drop. Let's assume now that it's in a equatorial orbit, and I want to talk from Hawaii through the satellite to France. It happens to be over Texas right now, so a guy is transmitting a signal from Hawaii to the satellite. It's over Texas. And the satellite is transmitting a signal over to a guy in England. The satellite is moving 17,500 miles an hour. It's in low Earth orbit. And assuming that Hawaii and England are within range, in reality it's not a good example, but make believe they were within range. Signal's not over the horizon. As the satellite goes from west toward east, the guy in Hawaii is going to be experiencing a negative Doppler on the uplink because it's moving away from him, but the satellite is moving toward the guy in England. He's going to get a positive Doppler. So the satellite is going to see a crazy frequency, but there's a slim possibility the guy in England sees the exact frequency that was transmitted in Hawaii because the Doppler on the up, which is negative, and the Doppler on the down is positive. They will almost perfectly cancel in that example. So you got to take each individual link, figure out what is the relative velocity, and hopefully those Dopplers are within the passband of the satellite, and figure out each one of those individual Dopplers. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGV. Yes, Dick, it makes perfect sense. But my question was, if the satellite is not geosynchronous and it's basically standing still, you've got the Earth rotating at 1,000 miles an hour. So as the west coast is approaching the satellite, if the transmission comes from there, and the satellite itself is looking for communications, for functions, so it's looking for, say, an 8 kilohertz tone, how do they compensate for that?
Now, you said the satellite is stationary and the Earth is turning underneath it. You can't do that. If I placed a satellite, let me pick a number, above South America, right over the equator, and I say it's going to sit still, and it's not geosynchronous. Geosynchronous orbit is only one particular altitude, 22,300 miles. Any lower altitude, it can't stay in orbit unless it is moving. You can't make a satellite sit still unless you're willing to compensate for gravity. If I literally went out there and by some means made a satellite, I let go of it while it has zero velocity, the gravity of the Earth will pull it straight down. The only way I could stop that is continuously blast a rocket engine on that satellite. I could make a satellite sit still while I'm continuously blasting its rocket engine just the right amount to balance gravity so that it doesn't fall down, if you know what I mean. And unless you've got an awful lot of fuel, you can't do that for very long, John. So you can't make a satellite sit still except in geosynchronous orbit. You think it sits still. It's in orbit. It just happens to be that its orbit is once every 24 hours, and the Earth turns once every 24 hours. So with reference to you, it looks like it sits still, and there is no Doppler in that case, even though it's moving. But you can't make a satellite sit still. But if you could, yes, you still calculate the relative velocity of you. Let me drop.
Dick, how far away from the Earth would you have to put the satellite to actually do that?
Yeah, I heard that. How far away from the satellite of the Earth? For a satellite to completely sit still. Okay. The answer is Lagrange point number two. Lagrange point number two, which is the one behind the Earth, 1 million miles away, it's now in stationary position compared to the Earth because it's in orbit around the Sun. So, yeah, you could make a satellite sit still by making it 1 million miles away from Earth, either 1 million miles toward the Sun, that's Lagrange point number one, or roughly 1 million miles away from the Sun, away from the Earth, on the opposite side from the Sun. So those are the two points where something will sit steady with no rocket fuel being burned. And now with reference to you, compared to the center of the Earth, it's not moving. But if I'm sitting on the equator, and the equator allows me to move from west to east at roughly 1,000 miles an hour, I do have 1,000 miles an hour of translational velocity. During the time I'm directly under the satellite, I'll see no Doppler shift. During the time the satellite is coming up over my eastern horizon, I'll see positive Doppler. During the time it's setting over my western horizon, I'll see negative Doppler. So it's a three-dimensional problem. You've got to figure out in every instance what's the relative velocity. So it's a good thing Barry asked the question about where could it sit still, and the answer is Lagrange point, and there's a total of five of them. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I was thinking more in station tending, where you could manage, you could take a lot of fuel, but I was interested in the commands coming up to this device, experiencing the Doppler shift and trying to make sense out of that. But very good. I guess we can go on to Wes. I think he's got a few questions. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's one other way you could be sitting still and be in some other place. When we finally do establish the space elevator system, and it's going to be a lot of years before we do that, that's this great big tether attached to the Earth. It goes out there a large number of miles, and you've got a heavy weight on the other end, and you've got this very long ribbon in between. and you got these machines that climb up that ribbon. Once you stop the machine anywhere along that ribbon so it's not climbing, you now, in theory, can set anything, an object at any altitude you like away from the Earth, and it sits still compared to the Earth's rotation. It'll sit still on that ribbon. So when we do establish that space elevator, and there's a lot of technology to be solved before we go there. Now, that's another case, but it's all relative velocity jazz. And it's kind of hard to believe that the two of you could be moving super fast, and you send a signal between the two, and you'll see no Doppler. If both of you want to talk to the Earth, yeah, you've got to compensate with that Doppler. Okay. I guess it's time. One last call. Anyone else with any questions before we go on to the more deep stuff? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RFM.
Go ahead, Alan.
Good evening, Dick. I've actually asked this question before, and you've answered it, and I just keep seeming to forget it. And maybe you could just give me a quick answer again. We had talked about DirecTV systems, satellite systems, and when it rains, we lose the signal, and you say it's not being attenuated by the rain or the rain clouds itself. You had a much more elegant answer. Do you remember that and what that answer was?
I sure do, John, and I run into that rather frequently where people don't know this one. The DirecTV satellite is a satellite in geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles up, and there's a number of them up there. And they're transmitting, I think it's 100 watts of power into a great big dish, and with your little 18-inch dish, you're receiving that signal. Because the frequencies that are assigned to that frequency, let me think, what frequencies are there? Something like 10.9 to 11.5 gigahertz. It's around 11 and a fraction gigahertz. However, there's not as many megacycles there as you would like. As such, each one of those frequency channels for that satellite is 70 megahertz wide. Okay. Let's assume that I round off the numbers now. The first channel is at 11 gigahertz, and the rest is megahertz, yes. So let me figure out the 11. It is 11 gigahertz, and I want to do 70 megahertz. So, yes, it's 11.07. So from 11.000 to 11.070 is channel number one. 11.070 to 11.140 is channel number two. Let's just talk about the two channels. And there's a, I think it's 30, is it 24? I think it's 24 channels in the KU band, as it's called. And in order to get a lot of channels into that frequency range, the frequencies overlap. You would think the first channel would be 70 megs wide, and the next channel would be exactly above it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You think the next channel would be adjacent to it. You know, the upper end of one channel touches the lower end of the next channel. That's the way you would think it would be done. And as long as you wanted to have half the number of channels, that works. They double the number of channels by overlapping odd and even. The first channel from, in my example, 11.00 to 11.070, channel number one, has a over, that's the channel number one, and the next channel, as I described it to you, 11.070 to 11.140, is channel number three. Channel number two overlaps the two. Channel number two starts at 11.035 and goes to 70 megs above that. Roughly 11.41, I think. 11.14. Here we go. 11.11. So they have overlapping channels. The way they make the channels not confuse each other is that the odd channels are all clockwise polarized, circular polarization, and the even number channels are counterclockwise circular polarization on satellite number one. And satellite number two, a couple of degrees away in space, you do the opposite. So because they have overlapping frequencies and clockwise and counterclockwise, Electronically, it's called orthogonal. In other words, because one transmitter and receiver is looking at only clockwise signals, he completely ignores counterclockwise signals. Let me drop. And that's for an odd channel, and an even channel is looking for the opposite. So because of circular polarization and high axial ratio, in other words, very accurate circular polarization, even though they completely overlap each other, channel number two overlaps half of channel number one and half of channel number three. But it's opposite in circular polarization. They don't talk to each other under normal circumstances. Along comes a heavy rainstorm on the Earth, and you're transmitting that signal from space through that rainstorm down to your little satellite dish, your 18-inch dish. The rain gives you a little bit of attenuation at 11 gigs. Not very much. Probably a fraction of a dB. And your dish can easily overcome that. That's the good news. But as the rainstorm gets really going at full speed, and those raindrops are no longer round objects, they're tear-shaped objects, the raindrops, and the water is reflecting off those raindrops and propagating through those raindrops, that beautiful circular polarized clockwise wave from channel number 1 and 3 and the counterclockwise from channel number 2 going through that non-circular object, that tear-shaped dropped object, all of a sudden the teardrop itself, the raindrop, starts doing cross-polarization. If my medium was completely linear, a clockwise signal stays clockwise. When the signal reflects off of a metal surface, clockwise becomes counterclockwise. When the signal propagates through an individual raindrop that is not perfectly circular, that's now teardrop-shaped, it starts cross-coupling clockwise and counterclockwise. Picture now a great big rain cloud that's a zillion miles wide and high and, you know, east and west and north and south and a couple of miles thick, and you're transmitting these very precisely made signals through that complicated medium of those tiers. That complicated medium of these teardrop-shaped raindrops, all of a sudden your beautiful clockwise and counterclockwise gets mixed together. They used to be separate. They get mixed. Now your poor little converter, your converter is sitting on transponder number 2, and because of this cross-coupling of the raindrops, he's seeing some of the signal from transponder number 1, he's seeing some of the transponder number 3, along with transponder number 2. That all gets mishmashed together, and he says, I give up. Forget it. Ain't nothing there but noise, is what your poor little very sophisticated electronics and your receiver is going to say. So during these rainstorms, when you get those fade-outs, it's the cross-polarization of the non-round raindrops that's doing it. When a great big hurricane is coming along and the ground station knows this is going to happen, they get around that problem by assigning another ground station in another location to talk to the satellite. And hopefully the rainstorm is over one ground station and not over the other ground station. They also do that during hurricanes, just in case the 39-foot diameter dish gets blown over, if you know what I mean, Alan. KC2RFN. I wonder if you can get that picture now. K2RIW in the deck net.
Yeah, Dick, I get it. I just have to remember that the raindrops are causing a cross-polarization, which is not at all what you would think. You would think that the moisture in the cloud alone is attenuating it, but you're saying naturally only dropping it down 1 dB, but you're getting a mishmash of channels that are literally overlapped 50% on each side. So, begs the question, if they were to cut the number of channels, just theoretically, of course, they'll never do this for commercial reasons, but if they cut the channels down to half and do not engage in this overlapping with opposite polarization, would it work through the rainstorm?
I say yes. Let's see what Eric's got to say about that. Go ahead, Eric.
Just to let you know, in this digital age, some of those problems have been mitigated by the way they actually don't have the transponders across each other. They have what they call half transponder satellites, where they alternate the transponders in terms of from horizontal and vertical. And by the way, they are linearly polarized and acyclically polarized. It's only the DSS satellites that are acyclically polarized.
Wait a minute now. My low noise block down converter for KU band reception is set up for clockwise circular polarization and counterclockwise. There's two separate preamplifiers in there with a plastic little rod, a plastic sheet. It is circular polarized. My domestic satellite receiver, I say, is circular polarized. But so what Alan was advocating, that if we half the number of channels, the problem almost goes away. And I agree with him, and I think you're saying some of the satellites are doing that to avoid the problem. But I think the KU band satellites are circular polarized, Alan. Here we go, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Are you talking about like a DirecTV receiver? Okay, that's what I said, the DSS is circularly polarized, but the commercial KUs are linear.
Okay. But even the linears, you're getting frequency overlap capability if you're using it, even though you've got horizontal and vertical. If you're using frequency overlap on a heavy rainstorm, I think you're going to get cross-coupling. So I think you're saying the half number of transponder satellites don't use frequency overlap, therefore they don't get that problem on the commercial satellites. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, what they do is they stagger. Right. It used to be one transponder was, one channel would be 18 megahertz wide, yeah, in the analog, or 27 megahertz wide if you're talking C-band, in the analog world. But in the digital world, we will actually use if I'm doing, a bit rate of 1.5 meg, the actual chunk of that transponder that we're using will be, what is it, about a little less than 3 megahertz. And what they do is they stagger the frequency use from vertical to horizontal. So when you're using that narrow bit of stuff at that particular bit rate, the opposing polarization has that slot empty, and the next slot up has activity there. So it minimizes the cross-polarization that goes on.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL repeater system.
So if I understand you correctly, Eric, whether you're using horizontal, vertical, whether you're using broadband, narrowband, whether you're using digital, whether you're using 16 QAM or whatever modulation, as long as you're not using any frequency overlap, then you get some nice adjacent channel isolation, and the rain almost gives you no grief. A little bit of attenuation, but this cross-coupling, in my opinion, the cross-coupling is a lot more devastating than the attenuation when it comes to going through a rainstorm. Now, when your satellite receiver has to look through the branch of a tree that's on your property, life really gets bad real fast. There you would think, Alan, that the signal being attenuated by the tree and scattered by the tree, you would assume that's the major detriment. No, it is not. A good KU band front end is running at something like 30 degrees Kelvin. It's a very exotic field effect transistor, very low noise amplifier, which electronically is running cryogenic. 30, 40 degrees Kelvin, a really good one. That tree on your property is at room temperature, 300 degrees Kelvin. If your eyes operated at that frequency, that tree is a blazing hot object, making a whole lot of radio noise. So when your satellite dish has to look through a tree branch, it isn't the attenuation of the branch that gives you the major grief. It's the thermal energy, random noise coming off that tree branch, because it's at room temperature. If you could cryogenically cool the tree branch without killing it, that problem would go away.
Ain't that crazy? Let me pass it over to Eric first to make sure he agrees with this one. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, that's precisely right, Dick. By the way, there are some satellites out there that are hybrid satellites that only have vertical polarization, or only have horizontal polarization. They piggyback on another satellite in a different set of frequencies. And by the way, we have KA-band satellites these days. For example, if you have DirecTV, you see some of these receivers, which have the three little round things on them. The KA part, and the range, really is very grief-giving on the KA part in terms of attenuation. Actually, at PBS, we use KA satellites for data.
Now, KA-band, I think, is close to 24 gigahertz. Somewhere around 22 gigahertz is the first resonance of oxygen, no, of water molecules. Water molecules have a resonance of around 22 gigahertz. So therefore, when you transmit through that rainstorm, there you do get some very serious attenuation. Is that true, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
That's very true, Dick. That's why we use it for actually, we transmit files that way. So if you do have a rain problem, the KA is for real-time stuff. It's for advanced time, and actually a lot of it is backed up with the internet, so normally your stream will come out of your KA satellite, but if you miss some packets, it'll call up the central server in Washington and ask for those packets that are missing.
What's the approximate frequency range that's used for uplinking and downlinking, PBS, on the KA band there? Eric, go ahead.
I don't remember what the uplink is, but the downlink is 23 gigs.
Oh, boy. You're going to get a lot of water vapor absorption. So I think you're saying that as long as you've got clear sky, you can transmit some nice, fast data. But if you're going to have a couple of days worth of rain, you better have a lot of stuff in the can that you sent previously, or be dependent on the internet, which is, I presume, a considerably slower medium. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, you're generally running about a week and a half in advance. The data rate on the internet is considerably slower. Don't forget, you know, a typical full bandwidth HD file may be, for an hour show, maybe something like 60 or 80 gigs.
Wow, that's a lot of data. And how big are the hard drive disks that you're putting the data on? And how many programs can be put on one of those disks, Eric? Go ahead.
It depends upon what you're talking about. It depends upon whether you're talking about original material that has been packaged for distribution or stuff that's been packaged for distribution. Don't forget, the maximum data rate that you're going to transmit television-wise is a little under 19 megabits, so no point in sending something that's full bandwidth, which is 1.16 gigabits. But the typical server that's taking the stuff down from KA that is already formatted and ready to go, maximum rate is usually going to be 45 megabits per second, so you can multiply that by 60 and then multiply that by 60 and get the number of gigabits.
Make me a rough guess. One hard drive will hold how many hours of program that's ready for broadcast, Eric?
Okay, we've got 3 and 6 terabyte servers that are online all the time. They're not only RAID 5, but they're also clustered. So you'll actually have 4 servers that are clustered together. You can lose one server completely and rebuild all the data. And the 6 gig, in the 6 terabyte thing is about, almost 300 hours of material, HD material.
Wow, 300 hours of material. And I think you're saying you usually run two weeks ahead of time. So in theory, if a real bad hurricane, set of rainstorms, and what came along, whatever came along, so you got really foul weather for 2 solid weeks, in theory, you could use up the, you could run through that buffer of stored material. You'd be running as fast as you can on the internet, and I guess in a worst case scenario, you'd have a little trouble keeping up. You might have to you might have to fill a broadcast period with some previous material. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, if you're a little station and you don't really have any money, you know, you could still actually run yourself a tape. But PBS has this thing that was part of their NGIS, or their next generation program interface. I have to get the acronym was for. But they put an edge server in your station, and they constantly pull it up with the PBS engineered programming. You know, things like Nova and Great Performances and the American Experience and all that stuff that go and fill up the edge server, which would then actually play out the material. If you're a bigger station, you have an archive. And I think the archive that we have holds 2,000 or 3,000 terabytes of the edge. But that's, you know, data tapes, traffic LPO tapes. It's a robot that goes and picks up the tapes, and it will actually load and unload at maybe 6 or 8 times real time. So you're talking about gigabit E, making your connection to the drive to your server, so you can actually dump stuff faster in real time and extract stuff faster in real time and store it. So if you're a GBH or an NEP, you'll never run into a problem. And if you're a little station, you really won't run into a problem because your local programming is all there already, and it's just the network stuff that you would be actually storing and time shifting and doing that kind of thing with.
Question. Who's that question? Go ahead.
KC2RFN. Eric, how long does it take roughly in time using KA band to download a file for a complete formatted program?
Well, depends upon, you know, how much you're paying for the transponder. So you can use very little bandwidth, you can use a lot of bandwidth. But generally, the stuff comes down about 4 times real time. So if you got an hour show, it takes about 15 minutes.
Okay, and this may be a little out of your area, but you may know. Can I ask one more question? Sorry.
Yeah, and I'm going to repeat that branch of a tree being hot, making noise, means that even though you got enough signal there, the extra noise the tree makes coming into the front end of the receiver lowers your signal-to-noise ratio below the threshold where the converter again dies. So when you're setting up a DirecTV dish, it's got to look at clear blue sky. Go ahead with your next question, Alan.
Okay, I got to remember, it's polarization through the raindrops and it's thermal noise. The other question is, I think that, and I could be dead wrong here, but I believe movie theaters are now moving to digital projectors. And I imagine they're going to just transfer the data, perhaps through the satellite or maybe the internet, but it sounds like something like KA band would be more efficient. Are they going to do that? And you know, what method of transmission are they going to use for distributing it to the movie theaters?
I can answer that if you like.
Yeah, is that in a case of a live event, like if this was the Muhammad Ali boxing event, and going way back in history, and you want to transmit it live into a theater, now if that's by a KU band link, you've got to pray for good weather. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, a lot of the theaters for the big live events, they tend to like to use C-band because it's a lot more forgiving. But actually, the method of distributing films for digital theater is using something called wavelet, is the type of compression that they have. It comes on a couple bits. They pop it into their machine, and that's it. And then there are actually KU and KA transmissions that will get stored in another receiver that receives the wavelet compressed material. And it's happening more and more. But they still hand deliver the dish, so, you know. The movie folks are still